You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 28th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Timothy Jost, emeritus professor at Washington and Lee University Law School, on the Supreme Court case that could debilitate the right of federal program beneficiaries. Then we'll be talking to Nick Weiner, senior campaign lead for the Committee for Better Banks at the Communication Workers of America. Sorry, that's Nick Weiner. On the attempt to unionize Wells Fargo. First, in a wonderful failure of bipartisanship, Joe Manchin's permitting proposal falls apart as the Senate moves ahead with the continuing resolution. Meanwhile, so-called frontline House Democrats clamoring that voting to diminish congressional stock trading could somehow hurt their reelect chances. Meanwhile, that stock act language is released and it seems largely useless. Senate poised to pass Electors Reform Bill to thwart a Trump-style elector fraud. Puerto Rico governor requests the Jones Act waiver to ease fuel shortage on the island. Chick-fil-A workers on strike in Ventura, California. New study shows top surgery drastically improves the quality of life for trans youth. Explosion causing leaks in the Nord Stream pipeline from Russia to Germany look very, very deliberate. Potential new Alzheimer's drug seems to slow cognitive decline substantially, and Hurricane Ian is just about to batter the west coast of Florida. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is, of course, Wednesday, and that is a special day around here because it's the day that we celebrate Emma Vigeland's most popular phrase. Well, the most popular phrase that you have coined, and that is?
Play Free Bird.
Hump Day.
Hump Day. There you go. Yep. She calls it Hump Day, and clever sense of like where we are in the week makes everybody feel like
it's a spatial metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Spatial metaphor to describe time, really.
Yep.
Yeah. Is time anything but space?
Still blows me away.
Is time anything
when you
but
came
a
up
hump?
And you dropped that gem.
It's what you pay me the big bucks for.
That's exactly right. That's right. And, of course, because of the way that your contract's structured, I actually own the rights to that phrase that you coined.
Yeah, right. So it's particularly exploitative,
Develop that work for hire. Develop that phrase, hump day. And we're just we have our in-house attorneys trying to work on making sure that we get a little just 0.01 cent every time somebody says it.
It's like Nike taking Kawhi's claw logo.
Yep.
That's a thing.
I don't know what that means, but. All right. Yesterday, we reported to you that students at high schools, multiple high schools in Northern Virginia, orchestrated mass walkouts in opposition to the governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin's proposed restrictions on transgender students in schools. And, of course, this is one of, and with all due respect to Rick Scott, who was on CBS earlier, I guess, this week or last week, saying that the top priority for Republicans is, you know, getting everybody to say the Pledge of Allegiance and also understanding how great America is sort of rolls in with education. And what was number two?
Immigration.
No,
crime.
Immigration was, crime was three. Immigration was four. Number two was...
saluting the flag?
Saluting the flag, I think that was number one.
Oh, sorry.
But nevertheless, we all know that actually the primary agenda...
A race on forms.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Thank you. No more.
How could we forget race on forms is a national priority?
No more questions about race on forms anymore. That people have been clamoring for that. But of course, really, the primary agenda point on the National Republicans' list of priorities is, of course, to be as transphobic as possible. And here is Governor Youngkin on Fox and Friends this morning trying to make that point.
So a couple of things. Are you surprised that kids, the indoctrination's already started, it seems, to have a walkout started by these kids as if having girls play against boys is okay and pronouns got to be are somehow already intertwined in the curriculum. So you have to undo and bring, give parents back the power to make their decisions. And if they decide, I think it's a great idea for transgender athletes to play with girls, and I think it's a great idea to change pronouns, they can make that decision.
Well, first of all, to begin with, we are having to correct, I think, a big mistake, which was previous policies that excluded parents from these decisions. And so that is a change, and I think it's an important one to make.
Kids want to be in charge still.
And kids need their parents. I mean, I actually believe that children should have a right to have their children,
what
their,
do you
their
do
parents
in a situation
involved.
If they're too scared to tell their parents because their parents will be against it?
Well, I think they need to trust their parents. And this is a moment where, listen, as you know.
Pause it. Now, look, people are probably confused by hearing this because when they're saying trust the parents, they're only saying trust the parents if the parents don't want the kids to in any way investigate their own gender. If the parents do support the children who may feel like they have been assigned the wrong gender, or if there's any questions about it, in that case, you don't trust the parents.
No.
Just to be clear, this gets a little bit confusing because they make it seem like there's a blanket trust of the parents. Now, of course, what they're talking about, again, is having teachers who are supposedly both indoctrinating students to be supportive of trans people and also have teachers be narcs on students that they observe who may be in any way questioning their gender. So it gets a little bit heady here.
Yeah. Teachers are both groomers and also supposed to be bodyguards in case of a school mass shooting as well, right? They fill multiple roles.
When, in fact, we all know they're indoctrinators. They've got their ENPHD.
And what Youngkin is banking...
Indoctrinating? Okay, let's...
But what they're banking on here is the fact that trans kids and their parents, if they're supportive of them, are going to be outnumbered. And so it's just like a mob mentality, mob rule to make sure that trans kids go back in the closet.
Let's continue to hear Youngkin essentially dress this up, right? I mean, again, this whole argument about parents... controlling what their kids, I don't even know what it is that supposedly the parents are supposed to be involved with here. But this is the way they also sell their racism. They sell their racism and their transphobia this way. They make up these lies about what is being taught in school or how nefarious it is that students should be taught about slavery or other things that institutions in this country that have been racially discriminatory, and they just make it about parents having the right to choose whether their kids learn critical race theory. In this instance, it is just transphobia. It is a way to signal to the people in the other half of the state, as opposed to the northern part of Virginia, that he's transphobic, but we're going to dress it up in the clothing of parental rights. Continue.
What do you do in a situation if they're too scared to tell their parents because their parents will be against it?
Well, I think they need to trust their parents. And this is a moment where, listen, as you know more than ever, yeah. Parents love their children. They've loved them from before they were born. And I have asked students to trust their parents. And this is a moment also where good counseling and a good teacher relationship can help engage with parents. This is a team, but parents have to be at the center of it. I also believe that this is a moment for us to step back and recognize that the moment that we begin to push parents out of families, mm-hmm. out of decisions around right. in Virginia, whether they wear masks or not, or whether the materials are appropriate for school, or in these most important decisions in their children's lives, I think we have all of a sudden taken a step so far out of bounds of what family dynamics must be, where parents deeply engaged in their kids' lives. This is a moment for us to step back, and I think right or wrong, that the wrong was to exclude parents from these decisions.
So it's basically saying you can be whatever you want, but your parents will be involved.
Your parents will be involved. Okay. Right. And if your parents, in fact, acknowledge and support an accommodation for you, then the accommodation shall be made. But at the end of the day, it right. is clear that parents have to be engaged.
You're not
and kids
change.
Can't make these decisions.
And you're not
going to
change because the kids walked out yesterday.
No. And I so respect the First Amendment right. That's
oh, give me a break. I can't hear this garbage anymore. I mean, to be clear, parents have not been taken out of this. He is basically saying to a child who has grown up with their parents, despite the fact that you may have every reason in the world to believe that your parents cannot accept you as you are, you should trust them anyways. He's not basically saying trust your parents. He's basically saying trust me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
obey your parents
regardless if they have an issue with what you're whether you feel like you're trans or maybe your sexual orientation, whatever it is. And the idea that parents have been taken out of this, that's not the case. There is no book on the law that says can't inform the parents of something.
Yeah. I mean, this is a story that's tried and true, which is that when kids try to like express their sexual orientation or their gender identity in a way that maybe their parents are not okay with, it's deeply detrimental to their mental health.
Yep.
And Youngkin is trying to make this like normalize it and make it the law of Virginia. And, you know, he's so deeply involved in his kid's life that he tried to get his son to vote illegally twice on his behalf. So perhaps that's the kind of parenting that he's advocating here.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsor. And then in a moment, we'll have Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor at Washington Lee University Law School, on. Today's show is sponsored by IAC Laser Engraving. It is a leftist-owned worker collective started by a longtime listener, Ryan Lubin, in September of 2021. Let me get some of this stuff out here because I've shown you some of these products before. They're amazing.
Hold on one second.
Oh, you have them?
I got them right here.
Okay.
I've shown you, the company is democratically structured to ensure that any hierarchies are justified and efficient. They use sustainably sourced materials coupled with extremely energy efficient laser technology that brings you unique products you're not going to find anywhere else. Your purchase of these items not only gets you a one-of-a-kind product, it goes directly to supporting a business model that is structured around compassionate and worker-centered care as opposed to the more traditional predatory authoritarian ones found throughout capitalism. All right, this I did not show you last time. We have three different products that we've sent. This is pretty amazing. This is a photo frame. It is made with 8 layers of Baltic birch wood. You can see that there on the side. It is sustainably sourced. It is hand-stained. It is hand-glued. Each individual layer is precision cut with a high-powered laser engraver. The built-in stand, which is down here, actually. Oh, it's on the ground there. The built-in stand features a frame with a living hinge where the wood is cut as many times until it becomes bendable and then filtered with a platform. See that? See that? Can you see that? The cuts there, the tiny, tiny cuts? That's the way you bend that wood. It's pretty nuts. The Graham also features acrylic glass, which is 10 times stronger than regular glass. And this piece is available for $85 at iaclasers.com. It comes in four different hand-stained varieties, or you can customize it for a unique look. And then they have and this is one of their specialties, 3D layered wood designs. This is an astronaut. It's made with eight layers of hand-painted, hand-glued basswood and eucalyptus. It comes with a stand for support or can be mounted onto any surface. This is going to end up in Saul's room. It's so cool. And this one goes for $75. You can check it out at iaclasers.com. In addition to this astronaut piece, they offer over 60 other 3D layered mandalas, animals, and mythical creatures. Custom options are also available. And last time, showed you a puzzle, a wood, puzzle that was carved, via laser. And they've got a bunch of different, amazing wooden puzzles over there. Again, this is these puzzles made with sustainably sourced eucalyptus. They use a high definition UV prime printer to render each image onto wood, and then they cut it into the desired amount of pieces. So you have 30 different puzzle images to choose from. But here's the part that's really amazing, and the pieces run from like 100 to 500 plus if you want, you know, a bigger puzzle. Not only does each puzzle come in a line box designed by them and a latch to keep your puzzle nice and snug, you can have custom family or personal photos can be made into wooden puzzles for an additional charge. So just an amazing gift for family, kids, parents, and great time to get that stuff now as you head into gift-giving season. We're not that far away. You can visit iaclasers.com to order yours today. Enter the coupon code MAJORITY10 at purchase, and you will receive a 10% discount on their amazing products. We will put a link to iaclasers.com in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor at Washington Lee University Law School, about a SCOTUS case that could obliterate the rights of federal program beneficiaries. This is another big one, folks, and we'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report here with Emma Vigeland. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Timothy Jost. He's the Emeritus Professor at Washington Lee University Law School. Professor, welcome back. I was just mentioning before we got on air, the last time I think we spoke was next door, I think it was in the old post office next to the Supreme Court when the major ACA case, I think it was Sebelius. I can't remember exactly who, what the specific plaintiff.
There have been a number of them.
Indeed, and that was the one where, at the time, we were talking about the idea. One of the elements of the case was talking about the idea that somehow the federal government did not have the ability to expand Medicaid, and. Just about everyone I spoke to on that day, I think including you, thought it's almost impossible to imagine that the court could find that element of the law unconstitutional. There may be other things that they, and of course they did. Yes. And it is with that in mind that I wanted to start this conversation with you because I think it has become clearer and clearer that the Supreme Court is going to do what it wants. Yes. Without being tethered to sort of notions of precedent or just the law or whatnot. Let's talk about this case. It is Health and Hospital Corp versus Tlaibski. What are the facts of this case, and then and what is that issue?
Yeah, George Tlaibski was an elderly man who was a patient in a nursing home in Indiana. And he was allegedly mistreated by the nursing home. He was over-medicated. He was transferred improperly, discharged improperly. And so he's deceased now, but his estate sued under a statute called 42 U.S.C. 1983. And it's part of the Civil Rights Act of 1871, the Ku Klux Klan Act. And what it basically said is if somebody has their federal constitutional or statutory rights abridged by under color of state law by a state official, they can sue in federal court to redress their rights. And, you know, over 50 years ago, the Supreme Court held that Medicaid is a federal statute. People have rights under the federal statute. Actually, then it was the aid families with dependent children, but the Social Security Act, state, federal programs, and that people whose rights were abridged by states and that the states weren't following the federal law could sue in federal court. And so the Supreme Court has taken this case, and one question is, whether nursing home rights under the Medicaid statute are the kind of rights that are enforceable under 1983. But a bigger question the court has taken is whether any rights under federal spending programs, Medicaid in particular covers almost 90 million people, but also nutrition programs, housing programs, and the question is whether any beneficiaries of those programs have the right to go into federal court when states violate federal requirements. And it's scary.
It certainly is. And this is just, you know, we have been talking on this program for years about how this court, both when it was sort of a hypothetical court, a 6-3 court, and once it became a 6-3 court, was coming for the administrative state. And this is one of those things that I had never contemplated. So we have a law that is passed during Reconstruction that yes. essentially says, and the reason why it's the KKK law at that time, or part of it was because there were elements, there were certain states who had a history of having a problem with the federal government coming in and trying to protect individuals there. Now, that section 1983 is a sort of like is almost like a machine that facilitates the rest of the machinery in some way.
Yes. Yeah.
And could you just also reiterate for folks, because I don't know if most people sort of realize this, the federal government can create rights. Not all one, you know, you have constitutional rights, but the federal government creates rights in citizens by passing laws. Can you just like give a brief explanation? And so, because I don't know if most people sort of realize that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution says that federal law is superior to state law when Congress passes a law that it has constitutional authority to pass. And one of the provisions of the Constitution says that the federal government can spend money for the public welfare. And since, at least since the New Deal, since 1935, we've had programs that have been set up under the Social Security Act to give states money to provide benefits for people, but the states that accept that money have to agree to comply with federal law. And so, for example, the federal law says that a state Medicaid program has to determine eligibility for everybody who applies and has to determine it promptly. States also have to provide certain benefits under their Medicaid program. And when states don't do that, the federal government has the authority to cut off their funding. Well, that helps nobody. But since the 1960s and 70s, the Supreme Court has held people can just go into the federal court under 1983 and sue to protect those rights. And that's what's at stake now.
And one of the other uses, my understanding, is that it is a preemptive infringement of those rights as well, right? I mean, that's can you talk about that element, which is so important?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, if the state says that it's going to stop providing dental care for children, for example, there was a case like that, people can go into court and get an injunction to keep the state from doing that. The federal government, again, has capacity to sanction the states, but basically their power is limited to saying, okay, we're not going to give you any money for that part of the program. And again, that's a kind of useless remedy. So it's very important. I mean, if people are going to have rights under these federal state programs, they're going to have to be enforced through the courts.
So you said there was basically two questions that are being addressed in this case. The first is the specific question of whether 1983 applies to Medicaid.
Right.
The second is whether 1983 applies to anything, right? I mean,
that's not quite right. The first question is whether 1983 protects specifically the rights of nursing home residents, because in 1987, Congress passed the Nursing Home Reform Act, and it said you can't, over-medicate people, you can't transfer people without going through certain processes, et cetera. So the one question is, can those rights be enforced in federal court? The broader question is, can any rights under federal spending programs be enforced? This still would not deal with other kinds of 1983 cases for abridgment of constitutional rights or other kinds of federal rights. But basically what they're arguing, and it's an argument that just to state almost sounds silly, but what they're saying is that federal spending programs are contracts between the states and the federal government. And in 1871, when the 1983 was passed, it was not possible under the common law for beneficiaries of contracts that they weren't a party to, third-party beneficiaries, to enforce their rights in court. And number one, that's not true. There have been about two dozen amicus briefs filed in this case last week, and one of them was by 19th century contract law scholars. And they said, in fact, in 1870s, the law was the opposite. Third-party beneficiaries could sue to enforce the rights. But secondly, I mean, that's the last thing Congress could have been thinking about when they passed the Ku Klux Klan Act. Can third-party beneficiaries? So just to state the argument shows how silly it is. But four justices have pretty much said they like this theory in earlier cases. So we're going to have to see whether they wake up or whether we can find a fifth justice here. And fourth and fifth justice, I should say.
As we address that question too, is it the case that it really is a contract between states and the federal government if the federal government statutes supersede the state's law?
Yeah, I mean that in one of the cases, one of the justices said it's like a contract. Well, it's like a contract, but it's not a contract. Because it's binding federal law. And so they have to abide. I mean, they have to abide by the law. And the law is, in fact, I guess, incorporated into a contract. States agree, but it's still the law. And it still is, according to the Supreme Court and according to Congress, enforceable by Medicaid beneficiaries.
How did that second question get into the case? Like, I mean, is that question, is that second question, is it one of those things where lawyers say, well, we don't believe that in this instance 1983 works relative to the statute that Congress passed about nursing homes, but in the event that you find that it does, we have a second sort of fallback position. Is that what was the way that this was introduced, or is this another situation where it's possible that the Supreme Court is going to go, you know, when we look at like the Dobbs case, they went further than they needed to, right? I mean, yeah. John Roberts, further than they needed to just to resolve the case in front of yeah. them. Yeah. Is that dynamic happening here, or was that introduced later, the 1983 applying to any benefit, you know, the concept of contract as opposed to like federal, it's just federal law, which trumps state law?
Well, I think I would state it a little differently. The original question here, I mean, the main question they're saying is you can't sue under 1983 for any rights under the spending clause. But if you can, then you can't sue specifically for nursing home rights.
Okay.
So they're raising the bigger question. One thing that's interesting about the case is it's not exactly clear how this case got to the Supreme Court, because this is a county nursing home. Talking Points Memo has had several articles about this now. This is a county nursing home, and there's no in Indianapolis, and there's no record of anybody ever having authorized them to go to the Supreme Court. But there's a lot of steam behind this from Republican attorneys general. They filed a brief from other conservative states, some right-wing organizations. So they are really chomping at the bit to get this issue before the Supreme Court.
Well, this is the perfect way for them to undercut programs like this, because these are the same states where this would be at issue, where they did not want to take the free money that was offered up to them with Medicaid expansion under Obama. So this allows them to essentially, through making it about a contract as opposed to federal law, undercut these programs from the ground up, and then we can maybe have a national conversation about privatizing some of these programs, for example.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It's and again, states and counties have filed briefs in this case to make that point. But there were many briefs filed. I think there were four or five briefs filed on the side of the nursing home, but there were about two dozen filed on behalf of Mr. Tlefsky. Also, the United States Solicitor General filed a brief in this case, and they kind of split the baby on this. They said, we don't think that nursing home rights are enforceable under 1983, but we do think that Medicaid rights are generally enforceable under various tests that the Supreme Court has put forth in the past. And apparently, I think the United States is going to have an opportunity to be part of the oral argument, and hopefully that will have an influence on the court as to the enforceability under 1983.
When the U.S. Solicitor General weighs in that way and says, we're going to split the baby here, we're going to basically cut loose the 1983's efficacy under in regards to the nursing homes. 2/3 of most of nursing home occupants are there because Medicaid is paying for them. So, right. but are they basically saying, like, we've got a 6-3 court, we got to give them something?
Well, they don't say that in the brief.
So. I'm asking you. Like, I mean, because at this point, right? I mean, you're the Solicitor General. You and you have an awareness of the way this court is functioning. they can do whatever they want. And this is basically trying to say, like, here's, we're suggesting a compromise.
Yeah. I mean, possibly. They certainly have consistently taken the position in earlier cases that that Medicaid rights can be enforced under 1983. And there was a brief filed in this case by members of Congress. There was a brief filed by former officials from Health and Human Services and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services supporting the plaintiffs. So I think they're fairly solid on that. And you're right. Most people in nursing homes in the United States are paid for by Medicaid. And as they get older, if you look at patients with dementia or patients with residents with AIDS or other kinds of serious conditions, the percentage is much higher. So this is a very serious problem. But I'm hoping at least they save the rest of Medicaid.
Is there, the last question I have for you is, if there is no, if they ignore the mechanism that was set up essentially to enforce federal law, where it touches in terms of money, I guess, within the states, does it begin to undercut the ability of federal law to, I mean, does it, at what point does it bump up against the Supremacy Clause? So in other words, we may get over the next couple of weeks, or month or 2 months, a marriage equality, statute that, to back up, you know, the Supreme Court, ruling, which we now know those things can ebb and flow, regardless of whether it was a pretty established right, or they could pass a law providing access to abortion, in all the states. At what point does, if you don't have the 1983 mechanism, to enjoin things, let's say, you know, that involve money, like at what point does the Supremacy Clause start to get chipped away at?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, yes, that's a problem. How do you raise issues? You could certainly raise it in a defense if you were prosecuted for something or if the state tried to stop you from doing something. But it is increasingly a problem how you enforce federal rights. And also, I don't know, I mean, under this court, freedom of religion seems to be kind of a get out of free card for anything you want to do, whether it's federal law or state law or whatever. So, I mean, as you said, this court does not approve of the administrative state or of much of what the federal government is doing. So I think that is a continual threat. In some situations, I think it's absolutely clear that 1983 would cover, or there might be other federal causes of action. But this court is very reluctant to imply causes of action where they don't otherwise exist, rights to sue.
Well, Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor at Washington Lee University Law School, when is the oral argument?
The oral argument is on November 8th. And let me say, I am really glad you're calling attention to this case because it's a complete sleeper. All these briefs were filed on Friday and there was virtually no coverage of them anywhere. And I think one thing we learned from the Affordable Care Act cases is if there is enough noise out there, the Supreme Court might pay attention. But if nobody's paying attention, I think the Supreme Court is even more likely to do whatever it wants.
I'm sorry, did you say the oral arguments on November 8th?
Yes.
That also happens to be the election day. So I imagine there won't be a lot of coverage on that day either of these cases.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, and that worries me.
Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor at Washington Lee University Law School, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Nick Wehner, senior campaign lead for the Committee for Better Banks at the Communication Workers of America, on the attempt to unionize a Wells Fargo. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Nick Wehner, senior campaign lead for the Committee for Better Banks at the Communication Workers of America. Nick, thanks for joining us. You are helping Wells Fargo workers unionize. Let's just, I guess, start at the beginning. Like, how did the Communication Workers of America get involved? Or is it, with this effort?
Sure. Thanks for having me. CWA started an effort a number of years ago, along with at the urging of some bank unions around the world, because actually bank workers in other countries in Europe and Brazil, Japan are already heavily unionized and form unions. And the standards in the United States in the industry was dragging everyone else down. So they came to CWA, and because CWA has a, in the telecommunications industry, has a lot of workers in call centers, there was a good fit to say, hey, let's see if we can raise the standards and working conditions for bank workers across the board. And it was in the last couple of years where things have really started to take off, with Wells Fargo workers wanting to not just raise the alarm about like the fake account scandal a few years ago. The Committee for Better Banks helped workers at Wells Fargo to speak out, because there was such unbelievable stress and pressure on them. But now they're turning the corner and say, you know what, enough is enough. We want to organize a union. We're not giving these CEOs another chance.
And part of the stress and pressure that was placed on them was basically a public blaming by the CEO of Wells Fargo, I believe, a few years ago, for some of these mid-level managers and people working at Wells Fargo for the signing up people for all these fake accounts, as opposed to turning the blame upwards. I mean, how did that kind of affect how the workers felt about their employer in this instance?
Oh, it's unbelievable. Like, the first action Wells Fargo took, I think, was to fire 5,000 frontline workers, bankers and tellers, and say, oh, see, it was these bad apples. We got rid of them. Problem solved. But really, it was rotten at its core, the whole culture. They had this mantra of eight is great, that you had to sell eight products to each customer that came in the door, or you were reprimanded and, you know, your job was on the line. So, that, you know, just went on for years. Just imagine if bank regulators had actually talked to bank workers directly, this wouldn't have metastasized for so long. So, workers seem like, hey, if something goes wrong, we're the scapegoats. And, you know, they try to then put a smiling face and lipstick, you know, to tell regulators, hey, problem solved, everything's good. And I still get, there's all these Wells Fargo alums who left, you know, quit, got fired 6 years ago. They're still involved with the Committee for Better Banks because of, like, the trauma from that experience, and are encouraging current workers to organize, like, you know, cheering them on because of what they went through and how they were blamed and retaliated against, you know, over the years.
I want to come back to some of that. I mean, I love the concept of 5,000 bad apples. They just all, it's like, at that point you start to look at the tree, maybe, is the issue. But I was just struck by the, and I think this is important to emphasize, like, the idea that international unions were looking at the U.S. as bringing down standards. Like, will you talk about that dynamic? Because I don't think that dynamic gets enough attention. I think there's this perception that, like, you know, Japan treats their bankers one way. We treat our bankers, you know, bank staff another way. Like, but that it doesn't work that way, does it?
Well, we know our global economy is so interconnected. And obviously banking and these giant banks operate around the globe. So the kind of competition and impacts on how workers are treated, right? What happens in one country impacts another. We were able to invite some bank workers, you know, from a large French bank a few years ago to our CWA convention to meet with U.S. bank workers. And there were some Wells Fargo workers, some from other banks. And the shock that the European bank workers, who have had a union as long as they could remember, on how bank workers in the United States were treated. And, you know, working at a bank is stressful at all levels, from, you know, Wall Street, but down to the tellers and everything in between. And we can get into that. It's just stressful handling your, you know, finances. Bank workers want to help customers meet their financial needs. So when you have this added pressure and your job is on the line and you feel like you have you're going to get blamed if something goes wrong, it's just enormous stress. So the European workers came here and they were just like, oh, my God, we've got to do something to help you.
And we should say that, you know, I would imagine, too, like if the operating costs for a bank in Japan are higher because they actually provide for their workers better, they're at a competitive disadvantage with an American bank. And that creates pressure on that Japanese bank to lessen benefits, I guess, for their workers, perhaps. Yes or no?
Well, you know, what I've learned is the banking sector is unbelievably profitable. And just to give you a sense, Wells Fargo, right, has paid billions of dollars in fines for, you know, breaking a whole number of laws, banking regulations and scandals. They still then had, you know, do stock buybacks for billions of dollars, and they still have billions of dollars in profits. And under political pressure over the last few years, because workers have been speaking out, like the minimum wage at the major banks, you know, a few years ago were down at like 10, 11, 12 bucks an hour. Now they're $15 to $20 an hour because they've, you know, been under such scrutiny. So they've been able to do all of that, right, and still run a profit. So, yes, there are, you know, competition and competitive advantages, but it's such on the margin to treat your tellers and your bankers and community service representatives and fraud analysts and, you know, mortgage processor. The list goes on of all the different obscure job titles within a giant bank. If you treat you, they can treat them well. And still, you know, make a hefty profit and with the banks in Japan.
I'm sure. All right. So let's talk about, there are 250,000 employees at Wells Fargo. How many of them are eligible to be in a union? Are there going to be multiple unions? Or is it going to just cover everyone who works at the bank who are not management, I guess? And we should remind people that managers are not allowed to unionize because of the National Labor Act of 1935. How many of those 250,000 are eligible? Will it be in one union, or is that the hope, or what?
Great question. And the short answer, it's a work in progress. We're figuring it out. But how we've set up the Committee for Better Banks, it's open to all bank workers and all bank workers within a bank. So a place like Wells Fargo, yeah, all the we welcome all non-management workers in the bank, and sort of figuring out what the bargaining units and how to breakthrough and gain recognition for workers that are organizing. You know, that's, we're still figuring out. There's a lot of exciting examples that like Wells Fargo workers in branches are looking to and seeing Starbucks workers having elections and winning store by store and saying, hey, you know, why can't we have an election for our branch and build momentum that way? You know, there are folks in different on different teams within office buildings and call centers that are, you know, working to figure out how can we, you know, can we organize our call center, our department, and build that way. But they're connected across the bank so that we're building a community and a platform. So we have a national organizing committee that spans geography and job title and classification. And so that's what's really exciting, and get to help connect, you know, a senior compliance officer in St. Louis with someone in a call center who, you know, Juan, who does remittance in Lubbock, Texas, and to build that kind of connections and unity so that we've got a foundation to build from so that we can figure out how to have that breakthrough and keep building. You know we can't stop at like one or two branches. We've got to, you know, keep organizing.
So is Wells Fargo, was Wells Fargo being the first bank to, you know, workers in a bank to attempt this, a function of things that are unique to Wells Fargo, or was it, or is it the first big attempt because there's this other element where, and just, you know, we've mentioned it, but just to reiterate, Wells Fargo had scandal after scandal after scandal, both frankly in the run up to the financial crisis because on the mortgage side, but in the commercial banking side, like sort of unprecedented numbers of people. You come in as a customer and you get a savings account, maybe a checking account, and people were basically opened up accounts in their name. Bank workers opened up accounts in their name for other products. Maybe it's a CD, or maybe it's like a, or we're bumped up to like supreme level of checking or whatever it was, because of essentially these quotas that were coming from the management. And this is the type of pressure that we're talking about. And there was no way. I know a lot of these workers attempted to sort of like say like, hey, there's a problem going on here. There was no recourse for them in a way that their job was protected to essentially blow the whistle on this stuff. And this is one of the selling points of the union outside of the bank. It's like you need empowered workers to curb the excesses of these bank CEOs and management who are looking or saying like, you need to open up 8 accounts, even though most banks have like 3 accounts per customer. Is that why this is happening at Wells Fargo? Because there's that sort of added element of a need for, you know, like an obvious need for protecting workers with, you know, just their ability to do their job in an ethical way?
Well, I think, well, here's the dirty little secret is that all the big banks do similar things, you know, that Wells Fargo has done. You know, just over the last few weeks, U.S. Bank and TD Bank and some other banks have been penalized by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and other bank regulators for having similar problems with pressuring workers that resulted in fake accounts. So it's kind of systemic in the banking industry, partly because workers don't have a voice across the board. Why Wells Fargo? I think it's because, right, they were the first and most extreme example, and workers have been trying to speak out for 6 years now, gone through 4 CEOs in 6 years, have been giving them a chance over and over again. And just as enough is enough. So there are workers at other banks that want to organize, but the, you know, it's kind of who's first and builds momentum. Then other folks are looking to like, hey, you're the leader. We're going to follow you. In terms of the big banks, a couple of years ago, we were able to organize a smaller regional community bank called a beneficial state bank that's based in Oakland. And the owners of that bank agreed to not interfere with the workers organizing union. So it's about 100, 110 workers at a few branches from Los Angeles up into Seattle. And that's the first time that bank workers have organized a union at a bank, in as far as we can tell, in about 40 years. There was a moment when unions were trying to organize banks, bank workers in the 1960s, but not much since then.
So what happens next? I mean, and to the extent that I imagine, like, you don't necessarily want to give Wells Fargo management a tip that, like, hey, this operation that's happening in Omaha, you know, this bank is there. They're ready to vote on it. So I can appreciate you don't want to get too specific. But do you anticipate, like, any type of vote or an attempt to get a vote from the National Labor Relations Board by some particular branch or unit within Wells Fargo? Like, where are we at in this process? You've mentioned it's been going on for years. Are we closer to some form of culmination somewhere within Wells Fargo universe, I guess?
Great question. So I think the short answer is yes, we are working towards a culmination to have some breakthrough, some set of vote or votes somewhere where we, but it's, we're really approaching this as a comprehensive campaign to support workers at Wells Fargo, to have like a resilient campaign that can withstand some bumps in the road. If we get a flat tire, we'll have a pump and we can fill the tire and keep going, because we know, you know, from all kinds of examples, how vicious employers can be once we actually get to the point of filing for an election. Right. You know, and we've started to hear some rumblings about management having, you know, closed doors meetings, talking about, you know, sort of the union threat, things like that. So we're being, you know, sort of cautious and making sure that we're training workers who are organizing in their area so they know their rights. They feel emboldened and empowered, so they're not, you know, going to be frightened at the first, you know, kind of inquisition from their manager. And in fact, you know, a lot of the frontline managers, like branch managers, are feeling the pinch also. So we actually get calls from us, you know, the first line managers too at Wells Fargo, you know, being supportive of the workers, or actually asking, hey, why can't managers be in the union? Which is an interesting conundrum that I've had some conversations like that. So, you know, we're focused on winning. And making sure that we can, you know, again, you know, withstand obstacles that come in our way.
Just to sort of add on to that question, and I guess this is, you know, we can keep this as sort of theoretical or generic as, you know, you're comfortable with doing. But are you guys sitting there and basically strategizing out that we're going to try and do that? That there is an advantage, and I'm, you know, just speaking hypothetically, but there's an advantage to doing local branches around, like, you know, sort of like vaguely based on like the Starbucks model, versus doing all the call centers or doing this type of employee across the country. Are you guys making that determination based upon what you think will ultimately create a more durable strategy and one that can build? Or is it more like we're going where the enthusiasm is and where we can get our first toehold?
It's an and, you know, strategy, not an or. We're teaching workers how to fish, right? So that they can, and we'll see where that momentum goes. And at the same time, what we're doing is what I think is different, and some extra tools that bank workers have, is that, you know, there isn't a congressional committee that oversees, you know, coffee shops, but there is for, you know, for banks, right? Because everyone needs a bank. They touch on every part of our economy and our lives. We all need a bank at some point. And so, you know,
the federal government insures right. You know, their solvency, essentially.
Right. And so, right. And just last week, you know, the House and Senate banking committees had a hearing where they brought in the top seven CEOs of the largest seven banks, including Wells Fargo. And, you know, for the first time, they raised worker issues. They asked them all point blank, hey, will you be neutral if your workers organize a union? You know, it was not surprising and revealing. They all said basically no, but we were able to bring a couple Wells Fargo workers as guests of Chairwoman Maxine Waters to sit in the audience and actually engage with Charlie Scharf during a break. He was very gracious at that moment. So it's that kind of thing where we can shine a spotlight on what's going on to help back up the workers and build political support. And frankly, you know, we think there's a role for bank workers to play in the supervision of banks. Again, if bank regulators had talked directly to Wells Fargo workers, you know, back in 2005 and 6 and 7, that whole problem would have persisted and been able to have been swept under the rug for so many years. So that, I think, is a tool that can help change the dynamics, change the incentives that Wells Fargo and other banks potentially could have instead of being so, you know, geared up to crushing workers trying to have a voice. We think it's actually, you know, in this case, to the advantage of banks to respect workers' right to organize so that we can have a safer and sounder financial system.
If I work at a bank, whether it's Wells Fargo or not, and I'm interested in, you know, starting to organize and, you know, and ultimately form a union, how would I get in touch with you for, you know, that kind of training and advice?
Fantastic. CommunityForBetterBanks.org. We've got a website. We've got a Facebook page, Committee for Better Banks. We've got a private Facebook group. Workers have started like a Discord server and, you know, Reddit thread. So there's a lot of community discussions that bank workers involved with Committee for Better Banks have created. But, yeah, just get a hold of us at Committee for Better Banks, and we'll get you plugged in.
All right. Well, we'll put that link in our podcast and YouTube description. Nick Wiener, Senior Campaign Lead for the Committee for Better Banks at the CWA. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Good luck.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program today.
Yes. Yes. What just came out of my
mouth. I don't. Yeah, you had a weird look on your face when I said that. Like you were really excited for the fun half today.
Well, we do have that one clip that I'm excited about, which is yet another Jordan Peterson. Mm. Fun for me.
Yes.
A clip of him being normal.
Exactly. Yeah. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help this show survive and thrive, you get the free half free of commercials. And then you get the fun half. What more could you possibly want? Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Get a 5-pound bag. Do yourself a favor. You can also get the Majority Report blend. All over Wisconsin, apparently.
Well, that's what Dorsey's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eau Claire can't stop talking about it.
Speaking of which, people can't stop talking about ESVN.
All right. Yeah, sure.
everyone's saying it.
It's a segue. Everyone's saying it.
Everyone's talking about it.
Sometimes people say ESPN, but whatever.
I count those. So on ESVN on Monday, we recapped the NFL Week 3, which had some stinkers, including Russell Wilson's performance. What the heck is going on with him? We also spoke about the Matt Barnes walking back some of his commentary about the Udoka scandal and how the NBA scoopsters and sports media in general, you need to question where some of the information is coming from, because it's often from agents or teams trying to get an advantage. Be a bit more disciplined in that way when consuming that kind of media, as well as was the extreme heat in the Miami Dolphins versus Bills game a labor issue for the NFL players. And then tomorrow we will have ESPN OT where Bradley and I will give our picks. Unfortunately for me, Bradley was undefeated over the weekend, which was a terrible feeling because I was gloating after my week one undefeated performance, not doing so hot over the past 2 weeks. Check that out tomorrow here on the Majority Report channel.
So you guys did not cover the final home game of the Worcester Red Sox.
We did not.
All right. No. I mean, that's okay.
It's a bit of an oversight. I apologize.
Call in tomorrow, Sam.
I could have given an update. top of the ninth, the Rochester Mets.
Mm. Sad.
Scored the 3 or 4 runs. That was a problem.
Mets so. Keep winning.
But wait till next year. That's what we used to say with the Red Sox. And now we pick it up with the Woo Sox. Folks, also, if you have friends who follow sports and aren't necessarily political, have them tune in.
Yeah, if you think Lamar ESPN. Jackson is an MVP candidate, you'll like my show.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. Okay. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
Yeah, big shows last night on Left Reckoning. Darna Noor of the Boston Globe, she covers climate-related issues. We talk about the IRA. We bash the Inflation Reduction Act, and as well as talk about some of the good things in it. And in the post game, available for members at patreon.com/leftreckoning, we had Cale Brooks on of the Jacobin Show to give his assessment of a discussion between Jimmy Dore and Jackson Hinkle about MAGA communism. And the funny thing about it is, like, at one point, Jimmy tries to get clarification on the difference between Marxism and communism. And I don't know if Jackson is the person to really do that, but it's funny because the other guys there asked him if he ever read Lenin, and I'm pretty sure half of Jimmy's politics have developed out of his aversion to reading anything.
Yeah.
it's funny to see him sort of finally get backed into having to deal with this theory, but just among psychos.
I think his entire program, like every shred of reading that he does. Over the course of a day or a week or a year or a month or whatever, you actually witness on his show as he reads like tweets and headlines.
You might even get out ahead of it if he's slow to read like certain tweets on the screen. You might be doing more reading than Jimmy does.
Yep. Reading something when you're not getting when you're not monetizing it for content is elitist.
Exactly.
Hillary Clinton does that. Come on.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. You can IM the show by picking up the app at majorityapp.com. It's free, iOS or Android. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts!
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this? Today?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day.
What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.